This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Conversations with Annalisa Barbieri. That's me. I'm a broadcaster and journalist, and my Ask Annalisa column appears in The Guardian every Saturday. Each week, I'm lucky enough to speak to some amazingly insightful, top-of-their-field specialists, and this podcast gives me the opportunity to speak to them in much more detail on subjects that come up all the time. I self-fund this project and I'd love to continue to do more. So if you'd like to support us and also listen to this podcast series free of ads, do join us over on Patreon, where you can also get the podcasts before they go on general release. Go to patreon.com/Annalisa Barbieri. Otherwise, you can leave a one-off donation on Acast Supporter. You can find the link for that in the description of this episode. Or just please listen and share as much as you can. It would also mean a lot to us if you left a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. The first time I made a will was when I got pregnant with my first child. But once I had children, I found it much harder to update it. This is because once you have children, you have to think about legal guardians if anything happens to both you and your partner. And who wants to think about that? So I did what so many people do and stuck my head in the sand until one day I was asked to launch a will-making project called Plan If, launched by the Child Bereavement Network. I told them I'd love to do it and help launch it, but I hadn't myself made an up-to-date will. On the morning of the launch, on the way to the launch, guess what? I met up with my solicitor and finally did it. But let me tell you, the whole way to the venue, I was convinced I'd be killed, simply because I'd made a will. So I understand the fear this subject evokes. No one really likes to think about dying and stuff like wills, but at the launch of Plan If, various people who had lost their parents when they were children spoke. These people were now adults, but some of them cried as they talked about not only the obvious impact of losing their mother or father, or sometimes both, but the impact of their parents not having made wills or attended to the very boring but necessary task of what I now call pre-death paperwork. I find using the word death purposely takes away some of the sting for me. This episode is about wills, lasting power of attorney, trusts and probate, and a few other bits to do with that pre-death paperwork. I talked to solicitor Gary Rycroft, who specialises in all those things. Gary is a practising solicitor and partner with over 25 years of experience in a small high street firm in Lancaster called Joseph A. Jones, and he is very much part of the local community. For a number of years, Gary was the chair of Dying Matters, which is now part of Hospice UK. Gary has served on the Law Society's Wills and Equity Committee. He contributes to various media outlets, including the BBC's Consumer Affairs programme, Rip Off Britain. But the reason he's my go-to for such matters is because he's not only so knowledgeable, but makes it all accessible and a whole lot less scary. So make yourself a cuppa and let me and Gary talk you through wills and things. Gary, hello and welcome to the podcast. We're going to be talking about everything to do with estate management. What would we call it? Sort of things to think about before you die. But what I want to get across is this isn't just something that old people should think about, is it?
No, it isn't. I would call it planning for death and dying, which sounds very miserable, but
it does.
there's no kind of spoilers here, but it's going to happen to all of us. And so it's better to expect it to happen and to put in hand arrangements. And as you say, if we look at the stats, of course, most people die when they're older, but sadly that's not always the case. And younger people do die from time to time. And that can be devastating on many, many levels. But obviously it can also be devastating if people haven't made arrangements.
When you say arrangements, do you mean a will?
Yeah, a will is the kind of basic starting point, but there's other things like life insurance. You know, if you've got a mortgage, what's going to happen to paying that mortgage if you're no longer around to do it? Having a conversation about a will is usually a trigger to start talking about these bigger issues.
Okay, so let's go through it. Imagine somebody's listened to this and they've not planned anything. What should they start with?
Well, as I say, the starting point, I think the catalyst should be making a will, because that should trigger off thoughts and conversations about your loved ones, who they are, who's going to provide for them if you're not around. It's going to start conversations about what assets you've got and what you want to happen to them. That asset sounds very grand, but we've all got something. You might be a homeowner, you might be renting a property, but you might have deposits in the bank, savings account, premium bonds. You might have things of sentimental value, and to be honest, often it's the sentimental things that cause the most anguish for people that are left behind. You know, I've seen situations in my practice where there's maybe been a second marriage, and the thing that's really upsetting the most for the children from the first marriage is that they've no longer got access to the photographs of them growing up, because they were with dad and dad's now died and everything's gone to stepmom, and they've kind of lost a bit of their childhood, they feel. So it's often the sentimental stuff that's far more important to people than the actual hard cash.
Well, I mean, I get a lot of problems, as you know, because you and I have spoken many times over the years about these things, about the cash, the hard assets rather than the sentimental. Mm. And one of the things that I think I've realised is that sometimes people who feel they haven't got love from their parents become very squabbly over the will. And it's almost as if the money stands in for attention and affection. And I see that a lot. So obviously having a will is a really good idea to stop squabbling, but that doesn't mean that a will will stop that, because obviously not everyone might agree with it. In this country, can you leave your estate, for want of a better word, to anyone you want?
The short answer to that is yes. The longer answer is not quite. So in England and Wales, I make a distinction there because that's a separate legal system from Scotland and Northern Ireland. In England and Wales, we do have what we call testamentary freedom, which means you can leave your estate to whoever you like. But there are restrictions to that. So, for instance, there's a piece of legislation called the Inheritance Provision for Family and Dependents Act 1975, which is a bit of a mouthful. And what that says is that if you're a person who hasn't had reasonable financial provision from an estate, then you're entitled to bring a claim against the estate. And the usual people there are, of course, spouses and unmarried partners and children, people that have some kind of financial dependency on the person that's died. So yeah, as I say, the short answer is yes, you can do what you want, but the more nuanced answer is you do need to consider certain people who would say that in life they had a financial relationship or dependency upon you, and so in death they should be treated fairly and made provision of some kind.
So just to be clear, if I left everything to a donkey sanctuary, do you mean that my children could possibly reasonably say, hang on a minute, what about us?
Yeah, my understanding is that your children are still relatively young and financially dependent upon you, Annalisa. So yes, they certainly would. As children get older and become adults, that financial dependency diminishes. And actually, there's an interesting case a few years ago where a lady did leave her estate to animal charities, not to her daughter. And the daughter challenged it. They'd had a very difficult relationship for many years, and that was why mum didn't want to leave her estate to the daughter. But the daughter brought forward evidence to say that mum didn't even like animals, and it was just vindictive for her to leave the estate to the animal charities. And the daughter was successful in in having part of the estate given to her. So if you are going to leave it to the donkey sanctuary, Annalisa, I would say show that you've got a strong connection to the donkeys, show that love for the donkeys to show that it's not just a perverse thing that you're doing, but as your daughters are financially dependent upon you at the moment, they are going to be entitled to bring a claim against your estate.
No, just if my daughters do listen, and no one in my family does listen to my podcasts, by the way, I'm not leaving it to a donkey sanctuary. But I have heard, I mean, you know, you're talking about that woman who was slightly vindictive, and, you know, sometimes people do that, they threaten to leave stuff.
I think that's very, very true, that issues that have simmered along for years suddenly come to the fore when someone dies. It's a kind of opportunity for family members to play out issues that have been going on for a long time. Now, as you say, a will can't head that off. It's not a silver bullet that's going to solve that. But I think there are approaches that can make the process better. So if someone is going to leave out a family member and then not got a financial dependency, so that's kind of okay from a legal point of view, you really ought to explain that. And I encourage clients to put it down in writing with me, you know, in a confidential way, to actually explain why they're missing out one of their kids, so that there is a reason that can be given if it's questioned. Because otherwise there is a danger that the family are just going to use the death to, as I say, carry on with some internal issues. You know, someone quite wise said to me once, it kind of changes the tectonic plates in the family, doesn't it? Suddenly someone's not there. And that person may have had a kind of role within the family, a peacemaker or whatever, and suddenly there's a vacuum there, isn't there? And people rush in to fill it and to kind of establish their new positions within the family. So it is a very significant time. You know, that's an obvious thing to say, but it really is.
No, I totally agree. And what I say to readers who ask is that, I say, well, ultimately you can leave your money to who you want, but maybe have a family meeting while you're still alive to discuss this. Because, you know, if that's what you're going to do, then I think you should face people and tell them. I mean, of course, ideally, everything would be split equally, but that's not always the case. Should you tell people what's in your will?
On the one hand, I'm kind of trained in confidentiality. But on the other hand, I say to clients, whilst I'll keep all this confidential, I would encourage you to talk to people for that very reason, Annalisa, that actually one of the other reasons that we have issues post-death is because people get a surprise, a kind of nasty surprise in some cases. So if you can talk about it with the family and say, look, this is what I'm doing, it might not be what you expect, but this is what I'm doing and this is why, at least people know.
What else should you think about when making your will?
Well, the basics of making a will are appointing executors. Executors are the people who are going to carry out your wishes after your death. They're going to be responsible for putting together a schedule of your assets and liabilities. So they're going to contact the banks and building societies. They're going to deal with the sale of your house, that kind of thing. So you want people that are responsible, good with money. And if you're getting older yourself, you want someone who is probably younger than you, because you want them to be around after you're no longer around, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So executors are really important. Obviously, many executors outsource the legal work to a solicitor or something of that kind. But at the end of the day, the work is being done in their name. They're ultimately responsible. And then obviously, it's about dividing up the estate and thinking about your particular circumstances, your particular family. What needs do people have? If you share your house with someone, presumably they want to carry on living there after you've died, so you need to think about that. You know, think about what financial assets you've got and how you want to divide things up. As you say, with children, the starting point is almost always dividing it equally between them. Parents want to be fair to their children, but sometimes children have different needs. If you have a child that has particular needs, a child that's never going to be able to look after money for themselves for whatever reason, you need to be realistic about that and maybe think about creating some kind of trust arrangement. And then there's all the other ancillary issues that we touched upon in terms of, you know, if you have young children, who's going to look after them? Who's going to be the guardian? What your funeral wish is going to be? Are the particular items of sentimental value that you want to distribute out to people? Are the charities and organisations that you've supported during your lifetime that you feel you can, you know, give a small sum to when you've died, because you want to support them in death as well as in life.
You mentioned legal guardians, and this seems to be, from my anecdotal experience, the number one reason that people with children don't make a will. They can't bear to think about that. And what really shifted things for me was when I found out, I don't know if you told me or one of my other lawyers, that the legal guardians don't necessarily have to be who your children live with. Because my thing was, if I die and my children are young, I might want XYZ to be the people they live with. But as they get older, they might need somebody else. So can we just go over that? I mean, who should you appoint as your as legal guardian for your children, and what do you have to think about?
Yeah, sure. Well, we still use the term legal guardian in wills, but actually the law's moved on. Since the Children's Act, which was way back in 1989, we now have the concept of parental responsibility, and we have the concept of residence. And so, as you say quite correctly, you can appoint someone with parental responsibility who doesn't necessarily have to have residence with that child the whole time, or indeed any of the time. And what the Children's Act also says is that the most important person, of course, in any decision about a child's future is the child themselves.
Mm.
I've often had will appointments with people with younger children, and we've kind of gone through the whole executors and we're dividing up the estate this way, then it comes to the guardianship and it's a real stumbling block, because it's a horrible, horrible thought to think that you're not going to be around for your kids. So it churns people up, of course. And then it's a massive issue for them to think about, well, who's actually going to do this? And that's from both sides. Who's going to, you know, who can we actually give this responsibility to? Because it's such a massive responsibility, and actually are the people that we actually, quote, trust to do it, and to do it in the way that we'd want our kids to be brought up. So it can be a massive stumbling block. And as you say, I think it can ease people's pain in that regard if you do explain that actually you don't just need to have one person that's going to be the guardian that's responsible for this child the whole life. Why don't you just name a kind of team of people, say, you know, various members of my family or friends who I would like to be involved in bringing up my child or children. And as my child or children get older, they must decide themselves where they want to live. That might be connected to where their own friends are, which schools they're going to, rather than sending them off across the country to go and live with their, quotes, nearest and dearest. Because, you know, it just might not be appropriate for a child to do that.
And it's important to remember also that if you don't make a will and appoint someone to take parental responsibility, then if you die, if both of you die, both parents die, then the court will decide, won't they?
Yeah, well, of course, the court will decide anyway. There will have to be a court order to appoint someone with parental responsibility in residence. What you're doing in the will is actually telling the court what your view is about it. So I always say to clients, this is going to be influential on the court, because the court will want to look at what the parents wanted, but it won't be definitive, because the court will look at it in the round. And as I say, the most important decision will be what the child themselves articulate and say what they want to happen.
And what happens generally if you die without a will?
So we've got the set of laws called the intestacy rules. So when we're kind of encouraging people to make a will, sometimes we have the carrot of saying, make a will because it gives you the choice of what you want to happen, and you can make all these decisions yourself, which is a great thing. The stick is sometimes the intestacy rules, which is, well, this is what will happen if you don't do it. The intestacy rules favour children and favour children's spouses and other blood relations. Now, so you might think that that's a really good thing. If you have a kind of traditional nuclear family, then, you know, people say, well, I don't need to make a will because everything will go to my spouse, then it'll go to the children. Well, that might be the case. But again, if you've got young children, the intestacy rules provide for them to inherit at the age of 18 years. Well, if both parents have died, there could be quite a lot of capital there, quite a lot of money floating around. You might not want your kids to have all that money at the age of 18. So although the intestacy rules might ultimately give things to the right people in your mind, it might not work out in the right way. And of course, there are significant issues with the intestacy rules if you're an unmarried person, because your partner will not inherit, or if you have a blended family of any kind, because it does give priority to spouses or civil partners over children. Mm. That can be a real issue.
Well, yes. One of the things that I think is quite a good idea is actually making children inherit if you want to leave it to children when they're sort of 25, because that's near to when the brain stops developing. I think actually 18, I'm not quite sure if I'd have inherited at 18, what would have happened to me. I was much more sensible at 25, 26. So it doesn't have to be 18, does it?
Absolutely not. I completely agree with you. For some reason, people seem to have in their heads 18, 21 and 25. I think 21 is the kind of traditional coming of age and maybe people have finished university. 18, of course, is the new coming of age. Most people go for 25, and I certainly, not that it's my decision, Annalise, when people make wills, of course, but I certainly encourage people to go towards 25 for that very reason, that scientists say that's when you actually eventually mature.
You mentioned executors earlier. Should they see the will, and can they be beneficiaries in the will if they're an executor?
It's a common misconception that executors can't be beneficiaries. They certainly can. And for many people, it's absolutely right that the executors are also the main beneficiaries. If you're an older couple and you've got adult children, it makes complete sense to appoint your adult children as the executors and for them to be the beneficiaries when you've both died. Of course, that means that the executor makes decisions, for instance, selling the house, which has an impact on the beneficiaries. So, you know, if they are the same people, then it can work really, really well. If you've got younger children or you've got children that you don't think are going to be suitable as executors, then of course you can appoint independent people to do it, either draw on family members or friends, or as a kind of last resort, you can have a professional executor like a solicitor. But I always say we are the last resort because there are financial implications of having a solicitor executor. And it also means that the solicitor has a right to administer the estate. And you might want your executors to be able to shop around when you've died and get the best deal for the legal fees, as it were.
Once you're dead, the executors should have sight of the will, shouldn't they?
There's no compulsion of you to show the will to the executors whilst you're alive. As a matter of politeness, you ought to ask the people you're thinking of appointing as executors if they want to do it, because it could be a terrible shock to them if you haven't, and they might, you know, panic and not want to do it. And it's better to find that out before you appoint them than after you've died. So do ask them if they want to be executors, but you don't have to show them the will. That's a judgment for you, again referencing whether you want to have transparency or not. But there may be confidential things in the will that you don't want the executors to be burdened with whilst you're alive.
But once dead...
Once dead, they absolutely need to see a copy of the will, because they've got to... They are responsible for carrying out the will, so they need to have sight of it then.
And what about, and I've had letters like this, if one person won't share the will?
This is tricky, isn't it? Because the will ultimately becomes a public document. So once you've died and your executors have applied for what's called a grant of probate, which is the legal document that's required for the executors to prove that they're entitled to administer the estate and to then close down bank accounts, sell the house or whatever they have to do within that role. Once they apply for the grant of probate, the will becomes a public document. You can apply to the probate court for a copy of anyone's will. The only people who are exempt from that are certain members of the royal family who seem to want to keep their wills secret from us all.
I thought you only had to apply for grant of probate if your entire estate and all your assets was over a certain amount. Is that not correct?
That's not correct. There's no hard and fast rule about that. It depends on the nature of the asset and how the institution or organisation that holds that asset on behalf of the estate wishes for it to be dealt with. If you go along to certain banks and the balance in there is £25,000, they might not want a grant of probate.
Right.
If it's £60,000, they may well.
I see.
But different banks have different rules. There's no consistency across the board.
Most of the time after people's death, grant of probate is applied for. Would you say that's right?
Well, I would say it's right for a married couple on the second death. On the first death, it's often not the case because assets can pass to the surviving joint owner automatically without need for a grant. And it applies when you are the owner of a house and you're the sole owner of a house, and that is then being passed on through your will. So I would say out of all the wills in our strong room here in the office, probably about three quarters of them lead to a grant of probate. Maybe a quarter of them don't, because the value of the estate isn't sufficient, or because they belong to someone who's in a married couple or civil partnership and they're the first to die.
But once grant of probate has been granted, the will is available for anyone to see, yes?
It is, yeah. Yeah.
I think that really shocks some people. I only found that out a few years ago and it was quite interesting, and I spent many a happy afternoon looking at whose wills. But you have to pay. It's a very small amount, but you do have to pay.
You do indeed. If you are doing something like leaving out one of your children from the will, it's better to do that and record the reasons in a separate document rather than within the will itself, because you don't necessarily want all your family issues to be aired in public, do you?
Oh, that's a good tip. Because also you don't have to, but it's a good idea to put in your will what your funeral arrangements are, and that could also be a separate document. Is that a codicil? What's a codicil?
No. A codicil is a minor amendment to a will. So, for instance, if you had made a will already, Annalisa, and you'd appointed two executors, sadly one of them dies and you want to therefore appoint a replacement executor, you'd probably do that under a codicil because you're just changing one thing, not the whole will itself, if that makes sense.
But other stuff like why you might be leaving someone out or your funeral arrangements, that doesn't have to be part of your will. It can just be a document that sits with it.
Yeah, exactly. You can reference it in the will. So you could say something oblique like, I've not made provision in this, my will, for my son, John, for reasons I've made known to my solicitor or my executors. So there's a statement, but then the actual reasons sit separately.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you live with someone and you're not married or you're not in a civil partnership and they die and they haven't named you in a will, where might you stand?
Probably in a very tricky position, to be honest. Under the intestacy rules, unmarried partners aren't recognised. So if you haven't made a will and you live with someone, your estate will end up going to your closest blood relation. It might be your children, it might be your parents, it might be your siblings. I think you have a real responsibility if you aren't married but you're in a long-term committed relationship to think about making wills to just protect each other. And actually this brings in another really interesting issue that I've realised over the years, Annalisa, that making a will is a legal thing, of course it is. On a more philosophical level, if we can call it that, it's about showing your responsibility towards people and your love for people, actually, that you care about them. If you haven't made a will, what are your family going to think? They're going to think that you didn't really care about what happens after you've died and what happens to them. Mm. So I think on that deeper level, it's really important to do it.
I couldn't agree more. We have a lot of blended families now. What happens if somebody was married, isn't divorced, but goes to live with someone else and then they die? Does a will trump the marriage or the marriage trump the will?
The marriage trumps the will. So the usual rule, and this is a really good point to get out there, the usual rule is that if you have a will but then get married, the act of marriage automatically revokes the will. The only exception to that is that if you expressly make a will, quotes, in expectation of marriage. So if you know that you're getting married, you can make a will that is expressed to carry on being valid after the marriage. This is another issue that I think is a barrier to people making wills, because they put it in the too hard box. And I'm sure you see this a lot, Annalise, with your letters, that, you know, blended families is almost too difficult to think about in terms of, well, you know, I'm in this relationship now, I might be on a second marriage and I've got kids from my first marriage and I've got stepchildren, and it's just too hard for me to think about. And actually, for someone like me, it isn't hard at all. It's something that we see every day, and there's really simple things you can do. You know, you can create a very simple will trust, allows your spouse or new partner to carry on living in the house after you've died, and then ultimately passes on the house to the two families or whatever. It's really simple. We do it every day.
You've mentioned a trust. Now, trusts give me white noise. What is a trust?
Yeah. Trusts are not just for people that live at Downton Abbey, you know, they're a very common arrangement. A trust is basically a situation where you have an asset that's looked after by trustees for the benefit of defined beneficiaries. Now, within a will, the executors of your will become the trustees, so they look after the asset for the beneficiaries that you've named in your will. Now, two very common examples of a trust created by a will are a gift to a minor beneficiary, a beneficiary who's under the age of 18 years or under the age that you've specified in the will, which might be higher, 25. That asset is looked after by the executors and trustees until that beneficiary has attained the stipulated age. Another very common trust is to do with houses, and as you know, people often own houses either with someone else or on their own, and they want to make sure that the person they live with in that house is able to carry on living there after they've died. And you do that by saying in your will, I give my house in trust to my executors and trustees to provide a home for my partner for the rest of his or her life, and then after he or she has died, it passes on to my children. So a very simple trust, but achieves what you want to achieve, which is for two different sets of people to benefit from the same asset at different times.
So it's a bit like a sort of intention of promise or something like that?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Inheritance tax, what is it?
I suppose the first thing to say is that anything that passes on death between spouses and civil partners is fully exempt from inheritance tax.
Right.
The other entities that are exempt from inheritance tax are charities and political parties. I wonder why the government put that exemption in. Anyway, so transfers on death between spouses and civil partners are exempt from inheritance tax. As individuals, we have an allowance for £325,000. That can be transferred between spouses and civil partners. So if you have mum and dad dies first, he leaves his estate to mum. Mum then has her own inheritance tax allowance called the nil rate band of £325,000. And she also has transferred to her 100% of dad's unused nil rate band. It was unused because everything went to her and she was exempt from inheritance tax. So mum finds herself at that point as a widow with inheritance tax allowances of £650,000. Now there's a further inheritance tax allowance that was introduced about 5 or 6 years ago now called the residence nil rate band. The residence nil rate band is worth £175,000 per person, and again can be transferred between spouses. So in the example we've got there with mum, she's sitting on allowances of £650,000. If she owns a residence, a house or flat or whatever, and is passing that on her death to direct descendants, children or stepchildren or grandchildren or step-grandchildren, she can claim an additional allowance of £175,000 for herself and also the 100% transferred residence nil rate ban from her late husband, another £175,000.
So if your house and all your assets come to under £1 million, you don't pay inheritance tax, with all the caveats we've just spoken about?
Yes, the main caveat being that you have to have a house worth more than £350,000 to claim the full allowances.
Yeah. Okay, I think I understand that. Anyway, go to a lawyer, kids, and they'll work it all out for you. Can you write a will yourself?
You can write a will yourself. There are certain formalities that go with making a will. So under the Wills Act, which has been in place now for nearly 200 years, the main formality is that the will has to be witnessed by two people who are together at the same time as you sign your will. So in other words, you need three people together. The person making the will signs it in front of the other two and then they sign their names. Now, that sounds relatively straightforward, but it often goes wrong when people are making their own wills. And the other things that go wrong are that people don't think through what would happen if certain people die in the wrong order, if I can put it like that. So, yes, you can make your own will, but actually making a will isn't very, very expensive. It's probably about £300 or £400, and not much more for a married couple, because married couples or couples of any kind are usually making mirror wills that are kind of similar to each other. Now, I know that that can be a barrier for some people, the cost. So I would recommend looking at the kind of free will schemes that some charities run. So, for instance, some of the major charities out there will allow you to make a will and they will pick up the cost. They're hoping, but they can't insist on it, they're hoping that you will perhaps make a donation to them at the time you make the will, or maybe even leave a gift to them in your will. The point of using a solicitor, and of course I'm biased about this, but we do kind of add value to the process, and I often feel that I've done my job correctly if I've sense tested what someone wants to do and perhaps persuaded them to do things slightly differently. Just through my own experience. So, you know, for me, that's a success.
You mentioned about if someone's not happy, and that's something I hear a lot. If someone in your family has died and you're not happy with the will for whatever reason, what's your first port of call?
Well, the first thing I'd say there, Annalisa, is challenging a will is not for the faint-hearted. It's an emotional roller coaster and it's an enormous financial risk. And I say that as someone who spends part of my time acting for people who are challenging wills. Before you start on that road, you've got to be absolutely clear that you really want to do it. You've got to be clear about what the financial risks are. It's not over quickly, and it's one that can be all-consuming from an emotional point of view. Having said all that, having given that kind of government health warning, for some people it's really, really important that they challenge it for financial reasons, because they've been left out of a will and that means that they're facing a very uncertain financial future. So I completely understand why people do it, but don't do it if it's just a matter of principle, because principles are very expensive in the end.
But if you do need to challenge it, would you go to a solicitor?
Absolutely, because it is fraught with financial risk, because there are very specific rules about will challenges that you've got to comply with. And of course, once you actually get into litigation and get into the court system, there are strict timetables to adhere to. For instance, if you're going to bring a claim for financial dependency, for reasonable financial provision, you've got to do that within 6 months of the grant of probate or grant of representation being issued. If you don't do it within that time frame, you're not going to even start, you know. So you need to take legal advice early.
And you've got 6 months to apply for probate, is that correct?
That's how long it usually takes. There's no timetable for when you have to apply for probate. There's 6 months for you to report the death to HMRC if there's going to be inheritance tax payable.
Do you have to pay inheritance tax in 6 months?
Yes, you do. You have to make payment of inheritance tax before you can apply for the grant of probate, which can, for some people, be a bit of a catch-22 situation, because they need to access the funds before they can pay the tax, and they can't access the funds without the grant. But I'm glad to say that the world's moved on a bit in the last few years in that regard, and banks and building societies will now release funds direct to HMRC before you've got the grant of probate, which is very, very helpful indeed to allow people to pay the tax before they get the grant. The other little tip to remember is that...
I've always thought the six-month thing is really harsh when you're also dealing with grief.
Yeah.
You mentioned if you don't maybe discuss it with the executors of your will, when it happens, they're not happy. What happens if your executors bow out?
Yeah, well, it does sometimes happen. Executors don't want to do it. Executors become poorly themselves, even die before you. So it starts off with the executors. They've got the right to deal with it. But if they don't or can't, it goes down to the beneficiaries.
And Gary, if you make a will and then 5 years' time you decide you want to change it, you can update a will, can't you?
Of course, you can make a new will at any time, as long as you've got capacity to do so. You can change your will and update it. And actually, that happens all the time. Life moves on, situations move on, friendships wane and develop. People are lost along the way. So, as a rule of thumb, I think 5 years is a really good period of time to actually get the will down from the shelf, dust it down, and see, is it something that needs to be changed? More often than not, it won't be, but sometimes it will be time to just update it.
And it's also a good time to have a conversation about all these things as well, even if it's with no one but yourself.
Conversations with yourself are great, aren't they? Absolutely.
So I think we've done a thorough recce on wills. What else is there to think about if you're thinking about death and dying? What about lasting power of attorney? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, lasting power of attorney, of course, isn't about death and dying, because it's about when you're alive and losing capacity or needing support to make decisions whilst you're alive. But the two things do tend to go together. I think if people are in the zone about making a will and thinking about death, then there might be a period of time before death when I need a bit of support and help. And that's where lasting power of attorney comes in. It's a document, a legal document, whereby the person who is making the LPA, who we call the donor is appointing named people, who we call the attorneys, to support them with making decisions. If they need support about making decisions because they are beginning to lack capacity, and indeed the attorneys can also take over and make decisions for someone if they are lacking capacity and can't make decisions for themselves. It's very common for LPA to be used for older people, but of course also there are people that have an illness or accident, that have some kind of brain injury, that where LPA would be helpful for younger people as well. So the government would like everyone over 18 to have an LPA. I don't think they'll ever achieve that, because once you're 18, you have legal responsibility for yourself and your assets, and if you're lacking capacity, someone needs to step in and make those decisions for you if you can't make them for yourself.
And there's two types of LPA, isn't there? Financial and health.
There are, yes. So there's LPA for property and finances and LPA for health and welfare. Now, my personal view, I don't know if you agree, Annalisa, is they're both equally important.
But, you see, I can understand why people find them really scary, because it's the thought of handing over power and control to someone else. And what about if that other person abuses it? So what kind of safety checks are there?
Well, yeah, and I'm sure you get lots of letters, Annalisa, don't you, where there are allegations of financial abuse. And it's a really tricky one. And the way I reconcile this with clients is by saying the most important decision about LPA is not deciding to do it. It's deciding who your attorneys are going to be, because they are the people who you're giving very significant power to. You know, there's no two ways about it. It is very significant to say, I'm going to allow this person or persons to make decisions for me if I'm lacking capacity in the future. There are safeguards that you can put into the document. You could put a preference in there to say, if there's going to be a decision about selling my home, I would like my attorneys to get a valuation from three estate agents and sell to an independent person and not someone connected to them. Or I'd like them to inform a third party, maybe a trusted friend or other family member, so that things happen in a transparent and open way and you're not giving too much power to enable people to exploit it.
But when would an LPA be triggered? I mean, who would decide that?
Yeah, this is one of the most difficult things. The starting point here is to think about the Mental Capacity Act deals with the law regarding capacity. And the really good news is that the Mental Capacity Act says that we should all be assumed to have capacity at any given time. So the starting point with any decision that you're making is that you have capacity to make that decision. And what that means is that people who are asserting that you don't have that capacity have got to prove it. They've got to prove that you're lacking capacity. What that also means is that if you are asserting that you have capacity to make that decision for yourself, you should be listened to. Ultimately, it's a legal test, usually implemented by a medical professional, that decides whether you have capacity to make a particular decision or not.
And also, as the attorney, everything you do must be in the best interests of the donor, mustn't they?
Absolutely, yes. So if you're acting as an attorney, you have to stand in the shoes of the donor and make decisions that they would make for themselves that are in their best interests and not your best interests. Mm. There is a department at the Office of the Public Guardian, the OPG. They have a safeguarding unit. And if you're concerned about the conduct of an attorney, you can make a report to the safeguarding unit for them to investigate and for the attorney to be asked to explain various transactions that have happened.
I suppose, Gary, a lot of people are worried with LPAs that it means that just by making it, you automatically give control to your attorneys. But that's not the case, is it?
Yeah, you're right there. Of course, it's not the case at all. Making an LPA is planning for the future. And I think the best time to make an LPA is when you are well, when you can make decisions about who you want to appoint without being rushed into it and without there being any kind of concern that you're under duress or lacking capacity at the time. So your attorneys are not going to be able to access your bank account straight away. They're not going to be accessing your medical records. They will only have that power in the event of you lacking capacity or in the event of you giving them permission to do that at a time when you feel that you're starting to lose capacity and need support.
And is LPA something you can do yourself?
LPA is something you can do yourself. The government have introduced a digital tool on the gov.uk website. Lots of people do it themselves. I will make the point that as a solicitor, you can add value to that process and you can sense test what people want to do. You can talk about different scenarios and how they might play out. That's the value that a solicitor can bring to the process and that you would pay for if you wanted to go through the solicitor route. But I'm bound to say plenty of people do it themselves using the digital tool.
Are there any other documents or anything else apart from wills and LPAs that should be in here, do you think, Gary?
I think connected to the LPA for health and welfare is the concept of advanced care planning. So under an LPA for health and welfare, most people give their named attorneys the authority to refuse medical treatment on their behalf. So as we are now, autonomous people who make our own decisions about our health and welfare, if you're lacking capacity, you can't refuse medical treatment. And some people, quite rightly, become concerned about that, thinking, well, if I'm lacking capacity, if I'm old, if I'm in a care home, I don't necessarily want my life prolonging. We're not talking about euthanasia, but we're just talking about prolonging life in circumstances where you would consider it not having value. So an example might be you're elderly, you've got dementia, and you're diagnosed with cancer. Would you want to have cancer treatment that might be not very pleasant? We will all have a view on that, and no one's view is right or wrong. It's our personal view. If we had capacity, we could articulate that view and say, you know what, I'm not going to have that cancer treatment. I'm just going to let it happen, take its course and die naturally. If you're lacking capacity, you can't make that decision. So people enter into a document called an Advanced Decision to Refuse Treatment, an ADRT, that sets out the circumstances where they would like their attorneys for health and welfare to refuse medical treatment on their behalf. Because it's one thing giving your attorneys that power and authority under the LPA, and it's another thing actually you stipulating when you'd want them to exercise it and in effect give them permission to do it. And the way I often articulate it, to be honest, is that under the LPA for health and welfare, you are naming actors who are going to advocate on your behalf. The ADRT, the Advanced Decision to Refuse Treatment, is actually giving them a script and telling them what you want them to say and when. And I think that's really important.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it.
It's actually a kindness to your attorneys that they know that they're doing what you want rather than being given this awful dilemma of what to do, you know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely lack of communication in so many things, but especially in, you know, matters like these can cause so much guilt and pain where if you just stipulate it and think about it in advance. I suppose in a way it's wills and all that stuff is, you know, a lot of people say like, well, I'm dead, what do I care? But it's really also, I think you said that earlier about thinking about the people you leave behind. Gary, thank you ever so much for making what's quite a difficult and complicated subject a little easier to understand.
Thanks so much to Gary Rycroft, and I hope it was all a whole heap less scary than you thought it would be. I do believe that the more we talk about these things, the less frightening it all becomes. If this episode encourages you to attend to some pre-death paperwork, well done. Do let us know at conversationswithannalisa@gmail.com. Plan If still exists at planif.org.uk. The best way to find a solicitor to help you make your will is by word of mouth, as I think it's really important to find someone you're comfortable talking to. To find a solicitor that can help you make your will, go to the Law Society's website, lawsociety.org.uk. It's under Private Clients, Wills.
The series is produced by Hester Kent. The music is by Toby Dunham. And our artwork is by Lo Cole. Follow us on Instagram at Pocket Annalisa, or you can email us at conversationswithannalisa@gmail.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, it would mean a lot if you could share it with someone you think might like it and also give us a review on iTunes. Please join us again next time.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, this is Annalisa. I started doing this podcast because it's an idea I really believe in, so much so that I decided to put my money where my mouth is and self-fund the project. I really want to keep releasing this podcast for free, so if you enjoy this episode, a way you can help is to visit our Acast supporter page and give what you can. You'll find the link in the episode description. Thank you.